On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the poachers came into Zambia's Luangwa National Park, they were deadly effective and completely merciless. With their AK-47s and meat racks and tusk carriers to haul ivory off the savanna, they slaughtered 93% of the vast park's once thriving elephant population. Then came a UN crackdown on the ivory trade and Mark and Delia Owens. The American zoologist couple had written Cry of the Kalahari and been thrown out of Botswana. Now they pitched their tent amid elephant bones and began to fight back in Zambia. For teenage elephants left adrift, for their human neighbors struggling to survive. Up next on Point, fighting for elephants in Africa with Mark and Delia Owens. Delia and Mark Owens, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Hi. And so, Delia, you're originally from Georgia, and Mark, you from?
Oh, a small farm near Toledo, Ohio, originally.
There were you. Were you right about gully wumpers?
What? That's gully wumpers.
Gully
Tom.
Wumpers.
Get
okay.
It right.
Okay, I'll get it right. Gully wumpers. Take us back to the very beginning. We're going to go into this to the park where you spent so much time and effort and found some success. But what was it in the first place, Delia, that took you and Mark all those years ago, 1974, I think, to Africa?
Mark and I met at the University of Georgia. It was very romantic. We met in protozoology class, and we heard a guest lecturer talk about the disappearing wildlife in Africa. And we just looked at each other and said, we've got to go do what we can to try to turn this around. That was in the early 70s. And so we were just determined to go, and we worked for a couple of years to make the money and took off with two backpacks and binoculars and a big dream.
One-way tickets.
Yeah, one-way tickets.
Right.
A big dream, and we made our way into the central Kalahari desert of Botswana and stayed for 7 years.
The romance of the protozoology class. I guess that was your Paris.
You like the cut of my cilia, Tony.
That sounded pretty great. There you were in the Kalahari. You went to study cheetahs but ended up focusing on black-maned lions, as I recall.
That's right. Well, this was in an area larger than – we were the only two people in an area larger than Ireland, and the animals there had never seen – people before, Tom. They were totally naive. They'd never been chased by trucks or shot at or anything of that sort. So we began trying to fit in right away. But the remarkable thing was that without fear of humans, these lions and brown hyenas made themselves our immediate neighbors in a sense. And we'd be talking by the campfire at night. And, you know, as the fire would burn down and we could see farther into the bush on the other side, we'd see six lions lying there just listening to us talk.
You've got this great scene in Secrets of the Savannah where you recall being asleep in a tent early on, a used tent that you'd got from some hunters there, as I remember it.
That's right.
Feeling something against your leg in the sleeping bag, fearing it was a snake in the tent. It was not a snake.
No, I thought it was a snake. I could feel pressure on my leg and hear this sort of shh, like as scales crawling along nylon, I thought. And then I heard the squeaks, rumbles, and heavy breathing, and I knew that didn't come from a snake. And I opened my eyes. I was sleeping on my back, looked over my feet, and the flaps of the tent were tied open. And as I picked up my head, I saw the silhouettes of two 560-pound male lions standing at the foot of – in the tent with us with their noses on our sleeping bags.
Okay, so your bona fides are sound with us here. We know you were there. You put many years into this. Delia, describe for us, as you did in Cry of the Kalahari, what it was that chased you out of Botswana and set you on the trail that ended in Zambia.
I think it was after we'd been in the Kalahari for about five and a half or six years, we discovered this enormous migration of wildebeest that had to migrate north to get water. And 250,000, more than a quarter of a million wildebeest were killed off by fences that had been erected across the northern part of the Kalahari, supposedly to protect the cattle in that area from foot and mouth disease. But actually, foot and mouth disease had never occurred in that area, and It had not ever been transmitted from the wildlife to the cattle. So we campaigned. We asked the government. We went through the proper channels and asked the Botswana government to take these fences down so that the wildebeest and other wildlife species, too, could migrate to the water sources that they needed to get to. And the government didn't want to do this, so we published some things about the fence when we brought this out in our book, Cry of the Kalahari. Mm-hmm. So the Botswana government took exception to our pointing this out to the world. But the good news is that in the end, they said we could come back, and they accepted many of the recommendations that we made in the first place. So the issue was resolved. It's not perfect now. They we helped pay for some water holes to be built in the northern part of the desert so that the wildebeest could get to these water holes instead of having to migrate outside of the reserve. So it wasn't a perfect solution, but it has been resolved, and we're welcome in Botswana now.
But by the time prohibited immigrant status mm-hmm. was reversed, we'd already set a direction looking for another wild site in Africa where we could do a comparative study of the lions in a more mesic or more, shall we say, hospitable environment with more rainfall. Cool. And that's what took us up Africa in search of such a place.
Up Africa, eventually to Zambia. The National Geographic documentary caught you there when you just arrived at a spot that became ultimately very important. Here's the sound of you, Mark. Years ago now, when you first arrived at what was essentially a vast elephant graveyard.
You can stand in this spot and you can see 4 to 5 dead elephants. I think it's despicable. I think it's appalling. I think it's a tragic commentary on the state of world conservation that this sort of thing can go on. And I just keep wondering when the world's going to wake up and really take some action.
Mark, take us to the North Luangwa National Park in Zambia and what you and Delia found when you first arrived there.
Well, the first problem was getting in there. We surveyed the whole area from – it was a park on paper only. There were no boundaries laid out, and there was no utterly absent of development. There were no roads, no bridges, no nothing, no human artifacts of any kind. And so we surveyed the area from the air. Now, this is a cross-section of the Rift Valley. It's 2,800 square miles. The wilderness goes for tens of thousands beyond. And to get in there, we discovered an old poacher's route from the air and began to take our trucks down along the shoulder of the Machinga Escarpment, descending a 3,000-foot drop of the great Rift Valley, the Western Wall, and got in there and began to explore and eventually flew our first aerial census, where we counted more dead elephants than living ones. And that was very sobering. And gradually we realized that basically instead of being a pristine wilderness, the North Luangwa, in fact, had become a shooting gallery for highly organized commercial poachers, cartels of them, acting very much like drug cartels in Colombia, for example.
And Delia, what was the toll at that point that had been taken on the elephant population in this vast area?
In the 1970s, there were 17,500 elephants in North Luangwa. At that stage, when we first went in there, the population had been cut down to about 5,000. So most of the elephants were gone, and at that stage, they were shooting 1,000 elephants a year in North Luangwa. And these would be groups of men that would go in that would number 150 carriers with 15 or 20 shooters, men with guns, who would go in and shoot the elephants and also shoot other wildlife species for commercial meat trade. And we want to point out that this was not poaching for need. This was poaching for greed. There's a big difference between subsistence poaching, when a man has to go out and shoot a wild animal for his family. These were highly organized people that were going in and shooting 1,000 elephants a year. It was a big business.
Tom, just to give you a sense of scale, by that stage, by the time we arrived in 1986, poachers had already killed 90,000 and 100,000 elephants in that Luangwa Valley in the previous 10 to 13 years.
Wow.
Now, that's roughly one elephant for every word in our book, The Eye of the Elephant, just for a sense of proportion.
You went in and got very close to the elephants that remained, found this was nothing like a normal natural range of elephants. I want to look at that. You also got very close to the people living in this area because you really couldn't confront these problems without engaging them. And ultimately, Delia, that's where you aimed, at some kind of finding some kind of balance between these two populations of human and elephants.
Well, what we realized immediately was that if we wanted to stop the slaughter of the elephants, we had to involve the local people. What would happen is that the poachers were operating like drug lords, like Mark said. They would go into villages and virtually enslave the villagers. They would say, you know, they would pay them a very small amount, just the amount of meat they could carry in one hand, to be carriers and go on these dangerous missions for 2 or 3 weeks to shoot elephants. So we went into the villages, and we said, we want to set you up with alternatives. We want to find other jobs for you.
Delia, you write about going all the way back to the 1800s, the long caravans that would snake their way out of Central Africa with enslaved men carrying ivory, white gold. That's still going on when you and Mark arrived there, and the impact on the elephant population, not just in numbers, but in the structure of that population, if you could describe it for us.
What we found was fascinating. Okay, it was very sad. 93% of the elephants were eventually shot in North Lwangwa. So we put radio collars on one female in each of 16 groups. Mark would fly the helicopter, and a veterinarian would actually hang out the door, and we'd dart an elephant and put a radio collar on them. And so we studied them for 10 years. And what we found that the elephants in North Lwangwa had been reduced to a population of teenagers. Most of the adults were gone. Hmm. Only 6% of the population were of breeding age. Before poaching, 50%. So we had these teenagers running around on their own with no supervision, and then we were amazed to see that the young males started forming gangs. They formed aggressive gangs. They would attack each other. They would chase unreceptive females. Then we saw that the young females started reproducing at half the age that they usually reproduce. So they were teenage mothers, and they were single moms. So when the family unit broke apart, what you had was you had an increased aggression, and you had a sort of breakdown of the society. It was very interesting, but also very tragic.
What was that breakdown, Mark? Was that a problem for the survival of the elephants?
Absolutely, because basically the population was in social chaos, which affects its reproductive success. In a normal population, relatively unstressed population, you have must males, which are 35 to 60 or 65-year-old males whose very presence suppresses testosterone levels and aggression in young males. Well, those older males and the older females were all gone. So the young males were literally out of control. And as Delia described, but also the older females. These are matriarchal societies, mm-hmm. where extended family units live together. Female relatives live together and share the responsibility of raising one another's and each other's young. And there's a lot of learning that goes on. For example, Cynthia Moss has found out, a famous elephant researcher in East Africa. Mm-hmm. Incredible person and a researcher who's found out that young females have to learn to move their leg forward to allow a newly born infant to suckle. Well, they have to learn that from older females.
It's not so instinctive.
Yes, it is. It's not instinctive.
Wow.
There's an instinctive component, but mm-hmm. it has to be refined with mm-hmm. experiential learning. So when the poachers moved in, it literally blew away with 93% of the adults. It blew away that collective wisdom that this elephant population had about maternal behavior and how to learn it, about where to find mineral licks, about the migration routes over the valley, and when and where to find fruits, and all of that.
A lot more than just numbers here. You describe on the male side, as you say, Mark, how it was what traditionally males didn't breed until they were 30 years old or more.
That's
the youngers
right.
were sort of kept at bay by the full-grown bull elephants.
Yes, and all the bulls had to do was show up, and the testosterone levels of the younger bulls, untested bulls, literally dropped to their socks within a couple of minutes. This has been well documented by researchers in South Africa especially.
It's amazing.
So that holds down their aggression.
Yeah.
Which was then left unchecked when those big bulls were killed for the ivory and taken out
exactly.
of the equation. Dilly, you
exactly.
describe this process of what you call all mothering among female elephants.
Yes, allomothering. And what that means is in the family units in a normal population that hasn't been shot can reach from up to 35 individuals. And it's made up of this core group of females who stay together all of their lives. So the group is made up of grandmothers and mothers and female cousins. And they help each other raise their young. Once a female has a calf, any of the females in the group will run to its assistance if it squeals. Mm. So you usually have this, an elephant family is a fortress of females because all of them help each other raise their young, and the calf survival is enhanced because of this. Then, of course, after the poaching, mm-hmm. Many of the older females were killed.
Tom, I would just like to interject.
Yes, please.
For the listener trying to get their heads around the impact of such devastating poaching, imagine that a town of, say, 100,000 residents in this country suddenly imagine in that town that the adult population, but only the adult population, developed a virus that killed 93% of all adults of breeding age. Mm. That is very similar to what happened to these elephants. They were lost 93% of the population, as we've said, and the youngsters were basically casting about trying to survive on their own without the presence of these elders.
You write about a group of orphaned male elephants in another situation in South Africa, orphaned like this, without those older role models, that went on a rampage and killed 40 white rhinoceros and only
right.
stopped when mature bulls were introduced. But you didn't have mature bulls left here in this corner of Zambia.
Precisely the problem. There were no older bulls. In over 10 years, I've flown for, hundreds and hundreds of hours over that wilderness. And over a decade, I only saw one bull that could have been approaching 35 years of age and who could have been a must male. They were simply gone for the most part.
Delia, you saw this immediately as a problem. We heard Mark saying that in the National Geographic documentary there years ago when he sat down in dismay at what was in front of him. What about the people who were living next to and near these elephants, who had known the elephants for generations there? How did they see the problem at this point, the villagers nearby?
Well, the people in this area love elephants. They really do. And they were very sad. We went to the villages and set up these jobs programs to give people alternatives. We also set up an educational program, and we would go to villages 10 miles from the national park, and we would ask the children how many of them had seen a living elephant, and not one would raise their hand.
Wow.
So these people were sad, too. And so we set up these programs. We improved the living standard of these people by giving them alternatives, jobs, and loaning them money to set up small businesses. We began a rural health care program. These people would have to walk 3 days to see a nurse. There was no health care in these remote villages at all. So we brought in a doctor from Johns Hopkins, and he started a rural health care program. We started an educational program, the jobs. We generally improve the quality of life of these people. We started in 14 villages, and it took a long time. It took years, but eventually the people could see that they could make more money from being a fish farmer or a beekeeper or raising sunflowers and having a sunflower press than they could from poaching. And the poaching virtually stopped. We were able to bring it to a halt, and that was just... it was when I said a while ago that when we first got there, they were shooting 1,000 elephants a year. Mm. In 1996, not one elephant was shot in North Lumongwa.
Mark, a big part of that was also related to the United Nations getting involved here and banning the trade in ivory. Can you remind us how that figured in?
Absolutely. Well, in 1990, the African range states requested that the United Nations establish a moratorium against the trade in ivory. And in 1990, it was approved. And And so at that point, it became illegal for signatory nations to the International Convention on Endangered Species to trade ivory. And I can tell you what happened to on the ground. Within 8 months, ivory that was trading for $200 a pound on the black market in our area, the price of that dropped to $1.56. $1.56. And so immediately the program offerings of our project became relatively more valuable to the people. And that, together with the fact that by now the people realize we were as much there for their benefit as for the animals, the wildlife, that really diminished poaching very abruptly, even further than our project attempts at that point.
But only with that ban. I'm reading here in the newspaper just last week, Hong Kong customs officials announcing a 3.9-ton illegal shipment of 600 ivory tusks from endangered African elephants discovered just last Tuesday in Hong Kong.
Yes, but two things. That's still not nearly as much illicit ivory as was being traded prior to the ban. And the second reason we still have these trades going on, these illegal trades, is that the United Nations keeps flirting with allowing signatory nations to sell their so-called official stockpiles of ivory. And I can tell you from experience that that poachers carry simple radios into the bush. They can be no more than a printed circuit board, a couple of wires, a couple of flashlight batteries, a little loudspeaker, and a wire they throw up into the tree. And they listen to BBC. And whenever they hear on BBC that the United Nations is relaxing its restrictions on the ivory trade, they start shooting elephants again on speculation. And the renewed ban has to be voted on every 2 years at CITES. So it's an ongoing problem, and they simply wait for a relaxation of the ban.
We're talking with Mark and Delia Owens. They've spent years in Africa fighting for many species. In this story, in their book, Secrets of the Savannah, Fighting for Elephants, you can join us at 800-423-8255. Devin is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Devin. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
This is a really big issue for me. I spent a year after I graduated college traveling southern Africa studying wildlife conservation, but particularly in a private context, what you call game ranching and safari hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I spent my time primarily in Namibia, but also in Zambia. I met at least 20 private game farmers and safari operators in Zambia, including in the Luangwa Valley on that side of the Muchinga Escarpment.
Mm.
I'd be interested in knowing what your guests have to say about the role of controlled safari hunting, this idea of sustainable utilization. It's widely, it's accredited for establishing rejuvenated game populations, but particularly in terms of antelope across Africa. Although I did experience cases where some private game farmers really wanted to get into hunting elephant on their farms, particularly in Namibia, where it wasn't so much of a culling operation, but these elephants had escaped from Etosha National Park and were just ravaging their farms, tearing down infrastructure. They weren't interested in hunting to cull, but hunting just to sort of mitigate some of these losses.
So you're looking at private game ranches where the game is there for the hunting and the effect of those. Delia, Mark Owens, what do you think?
Hunting can be a very important part of conservation as long as it's not an endangered species. And in fact, in our area, we helped the local villagers get hunting licenses legally so that they could hunt wildlife in their area, and it wouldn't be poaching because they'd have a license. We never said to the people, you can't hunt. And some trophy hunting can be important because it can bring in money to the area. It can bring money in that can be returned to the local people. So sometimes it works great, and it can be part of the whole package. But we were working inside of a national park, and all over the world, hunting is not allowed inside national parks. It's not in our country. It's not in most countries in Africa. So that was not an option for the particular area we were working in. Now, the game management areas around the national park, there was hunting allowed, and in fact, we helped a lot of villages in those areas, and we also helped the Game Scouts and so that they could protect those areas. So it can be part of the equation. But in some areas when the wildlife has been totally devastated, then you can't have hunting. And also with an endangered species, it's very difficult to have elephants hunted because they're so endangered. I mean, like Mark said, we only saw one male in 10 years that was over 30 years old, and 30 years old is the age they usually breed. And as far as being too many elephants, in some areas there have been crowding of elephants, and often this is because the numbers of people has increased so much that it has squeezed elephants into smaller areas. And so sometimes calling them is a suggested solution. We always like calling to be the last possible solution in some of these areas. If they could open up the old migration routes where the elephants used to roam, then culling would not be necessary. And we found this great solution in our area, and other people have found this too, of the crop raiding. Elephants sometimes do raid crops, and now that what we do is we have our team of people. Our project's still going on there now. It's 20 years old. It's still going on, and we plant chili peppers around the crops that the elephants like to raid. And it has been so effective. You have this mealy plot with corn growing, and you plant these hot peppers around the edge, and the elephants come in, they grab a few peppers and start sneezing. And if you have a runny nose and you start sneezing a lot and you're an elephant, that's a big problem, and it actually does keep them out of the crops.
African bush elephants, the world's largest terrestrial mammal, sneezing over the chilies there.
We also use beehives, Tom, around fields. That seems to be quite effective. And if all else fails, sharp rocks and so forth.
Can the sting of a bee bother an elephant?
Well, yeah, in certain sensitive areas, yes.
maybe not a sting, but 100 stings. And this, of course, the African killer bees.
But I would like to comment on the proposal to hunt elephants. Any proposal to hunt elephants at this stage that will inflame the illicit trade is contraindicated. And also, the idea of shooting trophy elephants in populations that have been reduced by 93%, such that you have basically adolescents doing all the breeding and teenagers, doesn't make sense.
Delia, you have this great account of the elephant named Gift and what she taught you and Mark about what was happening to reproduction in this decimated elephant population. I wish you'd share that with us.
One afternoon, we were sitting in our camp, and we were working in our camp, and we looked over to see this little elephant had walked up on the beach across the river from us, and she was only 5 years old. She was an orphan. The rest of her family unit had been shot, and she was old. At 5 years old, she was old enough to be weaned, but we didn't know if she could survive on our own. But she sought sanctuary in our camp because she felt safe there, so she hung around a lot, and she was just so great. She would just hang out in our camp. If we got too close to her, she wouldn't charge. She'd dance this little jig. Every time she'd do the same jig, she'd sort of trot toward us, turn 180 degrees, and trot away, and then trot toward us again. So we got to know her really well. And 3.5 years later, we were amazed to see that Gift had given birth to a calf at the age at 8.5 years old. She was a mother. And usually before poaching in South Lwangwa, elephants gave birth at 16 years old. So at about half the age of normal, Gith was a mother.
You had believed that to be physically impossible. So how did it happen?
Well, what it is possible to give birth at that age, but when the older females are around, when they are surviving, they usually suppress the reproductive behavior of these younger females. But when the older females were removed, then the ovulation set in earlier in these elephants, and they started reproducing earlier. It was like teenage girls or adolescent girls reproducing. And it was sort of the trick that the elephants had up their trunks, because we found that 58% of the births were by these young females. And the beauty of it is, by the time Gift was 16 years old, at the time she would have been giving birth to her first calf, she had three calves of her own and one little grand calf. So she became a little matriarch. And she, at first, was not a great mother, but by the time she had her third calf, she was a much better mother. And so In other words, it's elephants like Gift that are putting it back together again. They're now forming these little small herds and family units, and they're starting over.
From the midst of that devastation and bringing it back, and thank heavens they are. But at the same time, Mark, you raise issues of concerns about the gene pool when reproduction moves so young. It hasn't had the same culling that it normally would have, with elephants not reproducing until well into 30 years of age and more.
Well, that's right. It's had an in a sense an artificial selection exerted on the population by poaching. As we said earlier, the poachers went for the oldest individuals, male and female, with the largest tusks. And that's not the way nature would have operated in terms of exerting mortality on this population. So we have a bunch of young, untested individuals now doing all the reproduction, and we're just going to have to wait and see if they get it right. 6 years after we had controlled, together with the help of the ivory band, the poaching on this population, the population was still flatlined. There was no evidence that it had recovered at all. But now it does seem to be recovering. So the population has went from a low of 1,300, and it's back up to about 2,200. So the young kids are beginning to get something right.
So gradually.
Yes, they're coming, yeah. They're coming back. And you know, that's what we're so thrilled about, is that the poaching is over. In fact, when this our new book, Secrets of the Savannah, starts at that stage when the poaching is over. And it was a dream of ours. We were determined to do it, but we were never quite sure we could really make it happen. Mm. But once we got these programs going in the villages, the people got on our side, and they were so thrilled to have these new jobs. Today our project is 20 years old, and we've helped over 20,000 Zambians with new opportunities. And today the people in that area make 100 times more money than they did when they were poaching. And our project has been it's now directed by Zambians and run by Zambians, which makes us very happy. And it's been expanded from 14 villages to 52. And there's still rural health care in these villages and an educational program in each village. So it was just wonderful. It was a long struggle, it was. But to see it turn around and to see the poaching come to a halt and to see the people, we have chiefs that write us and say how thrilled they are that they now can see elephants again. And
in areas they haven't been seen in 20 or 30 years.
Wow, that's
elephants, hippos, buffalo. And chiefs are asking us to replicate our effort in their areas. Excuse me.
We have other chiefs coming in and asking if we can start our program in their village now.
To take that circle a little wider, we have a lot of listeners who want to join us. Nicholas is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Nicholas, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
I direct an organization called Forge. We work in three refugee camps in Zambia. We don't work with many Zambians, but the gist of our organization is we have college and university students that create, fund, and organize their own projects.
Where do the refugees come from, Nicholas?
Predominantly Congo. We have one camp that has Angolans, Rwandan, and Burundi as well.
Okay, so you're dealing with humans in trouble. When you hear Mark and Delia talking about working with elephants in trouble in the same area, what do you think of it?
Well, I really like the approach they're taking. We recently did an environment education project in our camp in Kala. At first, many of the refugees were tentative, basically coming out and saying, we're dying of AIDS, we're dying of malaria, tuberculosis, we're being forced out of our own countries. Why do we have the time to really pay attention to environmental issues? And it's something that we were prepared for. We really organized the program in a way to show the refugees that this could benefit them at large. And I think even though they seem separate, it's just a philosophy and a way of thinking where all of it combines and it can benefit the entire society.
Well, good for you with your work there. Mark and Delia, what about it? Here, Nicholas is working with dire human problems in the same country. Africa's got plenty of those. How do you look at your work with wildlife when humans are up against the wall, so in such desperate straits in so many parts of Africa? How do these pieces fit together?
Well, first of all, I would congratulate Nicholas on what he and his organization are doing, but I would suggest that the two are very much related. That is, that if you are in areas in Africa where wildlife populations are still vital generally the human suffering is not there to great degrees. It's only when human populations become a burden on the environment, partly, in other words, they're overpopulated. Mm-hmm. When the wildlife now has been diminished, you get extreme human suffering going hand in hand with that, those conditions. When all else fails, the one resource over the eons that has always sustained the African people has been their wildlife. And we still reckon that to be true today. So our approach was to try to raise the living standard of the humans and the elephant and other wildlife populations together until they were more or less on a parity in terms of the quality of their lives.
But the population has grown so much in Africa. Is that something like saying, you know, Americans might still draw sustenance from buffalo? I mean, is there really still a direct connection between wildlife and their survival, their flourishing?
Well, when human populations become so dense, it's because they're being supported by artificial resource bases. Mm. And the Earth is just about to tell us humans, all of us, mm-hmm. that these artificial resource bases have been depleted. We're living in a technological buffer, as Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute says. Mm-hmm. And at some point, especially with global climate change looming on the horizon and already happening, those resources are going to collapse. And we may find ourselves living on buffalo or wishing we could if we don't make some changes in our behavior.
Wow.
As humans and human populations and policies that control us.
Delia, I hear you there.
We're not suggesting that Mark's not suggesting that all the populations in Africa, the human populations, mm-hmm. could live off of the wildlife species. That's mm-hmm. not – of course, we realize that's impossible. But what we're saying is that the wildlife can be a great resource in some of these remote areas, for one, for meat, but also for a resource of bringing in tourists. I mean, tourism in Kenya, Tanzania, Zambia is one of the most important parts of their economy. It brings in a lot of money for a lot of people in the country. It's a very important resource for that reason.
Let me tell you, when
we were working with the villagers, we'd help them. Basically suggest that you can kill an elephant or a wild animal one time and get a one-off benefit, mm-hmm. and that's perfectly fine. That's been going on for eons. But now with so many other many people, with populations as high as they are and demanding so much from the environment, we're saying to them, you've got to look for other ways to make these animals relatively more valuable. And if you keep an animal alive and you expose that animal over and over again to a tourist who pay again and again to see the animals, they can end up being worth more alive than dead in today's modern world.
I want to hear from some more of our listeners, if we may. From Nashua, New Hampshire, Benita is calling. Hi, Benita. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question involves my visit to Botswana a few years ago. There were tsetse fly screens, and a lot of the trees had died.
Because of tsetse fly screens? What does that mean exactly?
Well, the screens, I think, were put up because tourism was a strong part of what the people were surviving on. It was Chief's Camp in Okavango. Mm-hmm. And because we didn't want flies, they put up screens, and it seemed to be the consequence that lots of trees were dying.
Why would a screen, you mean like a window screen? How would that kill a tree?
We don't know, and that's what I'm asking. Mm-hmm. If in trying to encourage tourism, you are making it more comfortable, and if somehow inadvertently trees are dying and the environment to support elephants is not upheld, thereby you lose the balance. I did see elephants when I was there, and it was an extraordinary experience. But
you're worried about the footprint of your own tourism there and that of others. Mark and Delia, what about it?
Well, tourism, ecotourism can be a good thing or a bad thing. It depends on how it's executed in the particular area. You can't alter the environment, the natural environment, to suit a bunch of tourists who are used to leather chairs and TV. You've got to get them back to the basics. You've got to get them out on foot, as the tour operators now in North Lwangwa are doing. You've got to let them get bitten by tsetse flies if they need to be. You can't start removing trophic levels of the natural ecosystem just to make people more comfortable because they're there for to experience Africa as Africa is. That doesn't mean you should allow them to get malaria, but again, you can't alter the environment in such a way that it damages it just to accommodate ecotourism.
Maya's calling from Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Maya. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yes, we can.
All right. Well, thank you. First of all, I wanted to appreciate your work, Mark and Delia. I read The Eye of the Elephant a while ago.
Thank you.
Spent about 3 years working on a dance piece to educate people about elephants where I actually sort of performed as an elephant myself.
Wonderful.
I'd love to see that.
What's that?
I would love to see that.
Oh, I could send you a copy of it, actually, if there was some way to find you.
We'll get you connected after you go off the air, Maya. Okay. What's your question?
My question is, in terms of bringing elephants, rehabilitating them, do you know of any interesting programs in Africa and what your thoughts are on that, bringing elephants that have maybe been in captivity or been in some kind of human-controlled program and then trying to reintroduce them into the wild?
Is that possible?
There have been some efforts to do that, fairly scattered and infrequent. The problem is that it's so expensive to move these large creatures around that, and so it's just so expensive that that money, one could argue, might better be used to protect the habitat of elephants, the natural habitat of elephants, and take care of the populations, indigenous populations that already exist in places. The evidence now suggests, although it's rather paltry at this early date, that the North Luangwa population, even though it was reduced by 93%, is going to make it as long as its habitat's intact and as long as poaching isn't resumed. And we tend to think that the resources that might be expended in protecting, say, two or three or four or few elephants in trying to reintroduce them, say, zoo elephants, for example, might better be spent on programs to protect the natural habitat of elephants.
Maya, thanks for your call. What is the overall picture, in Africa at least, with elephants today? What's happening with the overall population? Is it declining, stable, rising?
It is stabilizing after 2 decades of very heavy poaching. And the ivory ban was one of the most successful environmental policies ever adopted. Across Africa, in some areas, the poaching was decreased by as much as 70%. So quite a few of the populations were hit heavily by poaching, but they are starting to recover. So right now things look pretty good. And if we can keep the ivory ban in place, if we can spread programs like this that offer alternatives to poachers so they don't have to shoot elephants, I think that Africa has a very good chance of having a viable population that can help the local people and be there for all of us.
That is great to hear. Doing so well, apparently, that you're off to Idaho and grizzly bears. Mark, we've just got half a minute here. What are you doing with grizzlies?
We supported, for 5 years, we supported an Idaho Fish and Game project to recover the grizzly bears in the Selkirk and Cabinet Yak ecosystems of extreme northern Idaho along the Kootenai Valley. And we're also involved in securing grizzly bear habitat, but not just grizzly bears, wetland habitats in particular that are important spring and summer range for virtually all the flagship American species in the Northwest. Uh-huh. And so we're securing wetlands and grizzly habitat in general with easements and outright purchases
That's
of land
great.
When
from,
we can do that.
From Zambia's Luangwa to Idaho, we're grateful to you for your work in both places, in all places. Mark and Delia Owens, the new book is Secrets of the Savannah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Delia. Listeners, you can see pictures of Mark and Delia's work in Zambia at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.